Okay, so I kept the blackboard lights on because before I go into the talk, I want to tell you what I've been focusing on and what the central message is that I want to convey to the community. So I've been interested in, for the last few years, in understanding systems, so granular systems, but what I mean by that is they're sitting at zero temperature, they have friction, and there are no cohesive interactions. So they're dry grains, they're not liquids that form liquid bridges between them. And so for these kinds of systems, if I don't do anything to them, they just sit there in the single configuration that you put them into, right? So if I put a bunch of grains on this table, there are no thermal fluctuations. Unless I do something to them, they'll just sit in that single configuration. So all of exploring of configuration space is done by doing something to them at the boundaries or in the middle. So my primary question has been, how do we think of solids, granular solids of this kind, where any correlations that develop, and of course if I have a solid and not a fluid, I think we will all agree that there are some correlations in the solids that are different from the fluids. How do those correlations develop due to external driving? And I think the central message that I want to get across is not that I know the answer to it, but I think we have found a representation in which it's easier to identify those correlations and think of those correlations rather than think in terms of positions of grains. So it's sort of a reciprocal space. You know, people like who are as old as me or who come from the Hodgkin's matter background, you know, if I wanted to look at electronic structure in solids, I didn't look at position space, I looked at reciprocal space. And that made a difference. So that's the kind of argument that I'd like to make here. So what I'll show in this talk is what we have done with this representation, but it's the beginning of a story. It's not, you know, we don't have finished theories. But there are all kinds of issues that I think are easier dealt with in the representation that we'll present to you than in terms of positions of grains. So, and please, I've been telling people, please interrupt me because we are all here for extended periods of time, so I don't want to, I want to make sure that we can all talk after my talk. Okay, so I want to give a couple of examples, just physical examples where this kind of solidification has been seen. And I'll focus on one primarily. So, and so dry grains at low densities, if you shear them, they form a solid. What kind of a solid? How do we think of them? That's a primary question. So these are two-dimensional experiments that I'll focus on, and I'll actually lead you through the experimental observations of these particular experiments. So just to make sure that there's no change in density in the system during solidification. So neither temperature is changing, there's no temperature in these systems. Nothing is being vibrated, everything is done sort of quasi-statically in that first set of experiments. So no fluctuations except what's coming from slowly driving. So without any change in density, just by imposing shear stress, you get solidification. A similar transition has been seen in athermal non-Brownian suspensions. And interestingly, this is the context in which there was a paper in 98 where Cates and Bouchot and Claudin talked about this kind of solidification. It was for suspension. So I'll talk briefly about that, but I'll primarily focus on that kind of, the first kind of experiments. So in this second kind of experiments, you're starting with a suspension and you're shearing it at a finite rate. And at some critical shear rate, you see a jump in the viscosity. It's not the kind of shear thickening that people know about, which is can be explained in terms of hydrodynamic clusters, et cetera. What they know now from looking at simulations and experiments is that what's going on is that if you shear at a fast enough rate, you lose the lubrication film, and you actually develop frictional contact. So the simulations have shown very clearly, and I think that's the next thing, that if you don't have friction, then you don't get this transition. So if you take suspensions, you have particles in it. If the particles have frictional contact, and if the, by increasing the shear rate, you increase the number of frictional contacts, then you get this kind of rapid rise in viscosity. If the contacts are zero friction, you don't get it. So friction is important in drivings.
Also in the first point, of course, that's all frictional.
The first one is always frictional, right? There is, yes. So the first experiment is frictional. Mm. And I don't know of any granular materials that have no friction in them. So if you're doing experiments, they have friction.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
What?
They can have more friction or less friction.
They don't have much control over that. There are Teflon-coated particles that people use. No.
You can make them angular or round.
I'm talking only about round particles at this point. Shape is a different issue. I'm not talking about shape. I'm talking about spherical particles with friction or no friction. Yes, sir.
Can you show us the figure of what you just said about the viscosity taking a sudden jump? Do you have a figure?
I don't have a figure. Let me just draw it for you, and then I'll turn this off. I have a figure of something else from that experiment, but I don't have the viscosity figure. But the viscosity as a function of shear rate, this is the Newtonian fluid part of it, right? So it just increased. This is a normal fluid. And then at some shear rate,
that would be stress, right? Sorry, if that's Newton.
Sorry, yeah, stress. Let me just do stress. Let me do the viscosity, which means it's constant, right? So the viscosity is constant, and then it actually does something like that. And if you change the density of particles, this happens at different shear rates, but you can scale them all on top of each other. So the characteristic shear rate at which this happens depends on the backing fraction, but everything else is sort of scaled.
Would you accept if I replace the viscosity by yield stress?
Yeah, so the yield stress then is what I was sort of does this, then has a jump, and then does something else.
Yeah.
And I'll show you the yield stress.
Yield stress.
I don't have a yield stress plot.
Okay.
I have to think about it. Yeah.
So sorry.
But I'll show you the measured stresses.
If this is Newtonian.
For the Newtonian, there's no yield stress at the beginning, but then the solid has an yield stress, but that I don't know what it is. I don't remember off the top.
I have a figure that I can show you later on.
The yield stress? Okay. So most of these kinds of fluids are complex fluids. So they have, it can either be a fluid with an yield stress. So Newtonian, right? If I have fluids, then the shear stress should go as the viscosity times gamma dot. If I have an elastic solid, that goes as, right, so that's my simple Newtonian, either fluid or solid. Can you guys see what I'm writing?
Okay.
So elastic. Or let me write solid. Fluid and solid. Gamma is the strain or strain rate. Right. Gamma is the strain, gamma dot is the strain rate. But in yield stress fluids or solids, what you will get is some yield stress. And then some, most generically, you can get this to some power. I have forgotten what that exponent is normally denoted in which Greek letter, but. Right, so the solids that we, but this is all, so this is actually a good point. So this is all about thermal systems, right? Now the question, I think, the kinds of solids that I'll talk about. So any, almost any material that you think about will have an yield stress and then it'll flow beyond that yield stress. But the way things go up with the shear rate doesn't always have to be linear. Right, so shear thinning, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's an open question as to whether these descriptions apply to the kind of fluids or solids that I'm talking about. And so for granular materials, in some of Bob Berenger's experiments, what you find is the stress goes up logarithmically with the strain rate. So these are solids. In this, they would call them solids, but the stress goes up logarithmically.
In 2D, right?
All in 2D, yeah. So most of the things that I'll talk about are everything that I'll talk about today is in 2D. Mm-hmm.
So again, I think it was sort of the last line.
Yeah.
The yield. So sigma y, that's the yield stress.
Yes.
So it's a function of gamma, or what is it?
No, so let's see.
It's a constant?
Yes, it's a constant, yes. So this fluid, it's a fluid with an yield stress. So it behaves as a fluid if I exceed the yield stress. But beyond, before that?
Yeah, so what's the description for sigma less than sigma y?
So let's say, so sigma as a function of gamma dot, right, would just be somewhere here.
So that point is elastic?
Yes.
Exactly.
So
it looks like
the second one. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, is this all, when you have first order transition, you have this shear thickening, is it hysteretic or what happens?
Yes, it's hysteretic. It's hysteretic. All of these things have hysteresis. So, yeah, so one way you identify the transition is that it's hysteretic. The flow curves are hysteretic. And I'll show you the hysteresis in these dry rims, which are quasi-static, so no shear rate in them. Okay, so the qualitative understanding of both of these phenomena is that grains have a tendency that has been known for many, many years. It's called Reynolds dilatancy. So if you shear, they tend to dilate. So if you shear grains, the volume goes up.
This is that
goes up.
It can be shear rate or shear strength.
Goes up.
So the rough argument is this: I have hard particles that are close packed. So if I shear them, for them to move, they have to find space.
And what's the understanding of that?
Very little. Very, very little. Very, very little fundamental understanding.
Is it possible that when you shear, you cause disorder, and the disorder leads to expansion?
So all of these things, I, as far as I know, people restrict themselves to disordered systems. But so let me just say, I don't think dilatancy is very well understood. But this is the mirror image. So what you're doing now is if you keep constant volume and shear, the qualitative understanding of both of these processes is that you're frustrating that tendency to dilate. It cannot dilate. So if it cannot dilate, then what kind of states do they go into, right? And so the rough picture is if I don't let them dilate, the particles have to run into each other and then they create more contacts and then they become more solid-like. But that's the qualitative understanding, right? So all of both of these kinds of experiments have been qualitatively discussed in the context of saying, if we don't let it dilate, it makes sense that this happens. And I'll show you some experiments from Bob Berenger.
Where you showed this jump in the viscosity.
Yes.
It's a constant volume.
If you don't do constant volume, you don't see this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you don't do constant volume, you don't see discontinuous shear thickening, nor do you see shear jumping.
What does it look like in a case?
I don't think you see anything.
Okay.
Yeah. Pretty sure. So they're pretty dramatic pictures from Heinrich Jaeger's group where you see that if you, but here the constant volume is, in the fluids case, the constant volume is not exact. In the granular case it is. So it's essentially because the fluid is incompressible that you're making the suspension behave as if it's in a constant volume. The fluid that the particles are in, the fluid is incompressible, so it's sort of in a constant volume situation. You're not putting hard, rigid walls. But in that case, you have these dramatic pictures where you see the grains essentially pushing out on the fluid membrane, and you see that as you increase the shear rate, That's essentially what they're trying to do. But since they can't push out, they form a solid. Right? So I don't have any of those pictures with me. I can find them. Okay, so simulations of the suspensions definitely show that if there's no friction, you don't get this effect. The case of for granular is still seems to be a little murky. Whether you get it or not with frictionless particles is still up in the air. Okay, so that's what I want to think about. These kinds of solids and these kinds of transitions. Okay, so this is a cartoon that I think is a pretty good cartoon of what happens. And this is a quote from this 98 paper by Kate Claudia Bushell Whitmer, I think. And this is what they say, and this they were actually talking about experiments that were done even before then on athermal suspensions. And the idea is basically this, that if you put a load, then you can actually create force bearing structures which support that load. So let me see. So you create an array or network of force chains that can support the shear stress that was used to create them. But they might not be able to support other shear stresses. So if I have only force chains in this direction, now, so all of these particles, they call them spectator particles. They could be rattlers, they could be just like close to touching. But these are the ones that are bearing the forces. So now if I push in the direction that the force chains are, they can support that load. But if I change the force just even a little bit, they'll buckle. So they can support indefinitely the load in the direction that the force chains exist. So from that perspective, it's a solid, but what kind of a solid is it? It's not elastic. So they had a very particular picture of how to think about stress transmission in these kinds of solids. What I'll show you is the experiments that we talk about completely they verify this cartoon picture, but I think we understand a bit more now. So these networks could be one-dimensional, they could be two-dimensional. Once they're two-dimensional, then they of course can support stresses in other directions too. But the main thing that they were pointing out in this paper is that these solids are created purely by the imposition of stress, not by changing density or anything. The solidity stems directly from the applied stress itself. So the grays are maybe smaller forces, and you're connecting up force chains. So yeah, I'll come back to those. They actually are important. Okay, so I'm going to actually show you an experiment, but let me first turn this light off. So these are experiments from Bob Berenger's group. And these are grains lying on top of a table, so 2D. Right? So there is no gravity. And these are sitting on slats, and the geometry is such, and I don't want to get too much into it, but they designed the geometry so that there are actually no shear bands in this system. This is homogeneously shear. So the shear strain is actually homogeneous. Right. So in their previous experiments, they're shear bands, which to us it's not important, but it complicates the picture because then the system is inhomogeneous. So this is homogeneous shear. And this is sitting at some particular density, and then what you will see. What you'll see is that as we shear, you will see that sort of cartoon picture of Kate's being realized. Let me pause and just, right? So what happened was they started from a rectangular box. At low enough density that you see a few forces. Oh, so I should tell people who have never seen these. So these are photoelastic cylinders. They are fat cylinders. So they're photoelastic, so they're looking at it through polarizers, so the birefringence pattern is what tells you about the stresses. And they have been working with this since when? Late 90s? So they now have algorithms that are good enough that can actually, from the birefringent images, tell us what the contact forces are at every contact and tell us which are the tangential forces and which are the normal forces. So you get a full force map from these experiments. And the other thing they do is they have another way of looking at it, these grains. If you just look at them through UV light, they have a line on them so they can keep track of the rotations of the grains. So the experiments have all of the information that is that I wish to know. Okay, so this is what happens as you shear. Right? So you're forming these force chains, but lots and lots of particles have essentially zero force in them.
Not only do you have chains, but you have some patterning emerging.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So there are cells, like cell forming.
These are self-organized patterns that are being generated purely due to this driving. And this is quasi-static. So every time they step forward and strain, they let things relax. Or there's no vibration going on, so there's not much relaxation anywhere. But they're not being driven at a finite rate. Yeah?
There seems to be a preferred direction like this.
Yes, because the grains are compressive. There's only compressive forces, right? So if I shear in a, so when I shear, there's a tensile direction and a compressive direction.
Yeah.
So the force chains form only along the compressive direction. Yeah. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah.
I should think it was free.
Say that again.
Free.
Should I? I don't know. Right? So are these fragile solids or fluids? Right? Yeah.
So this is at a constant shear rate?
Shear rate is zero, quasi-static. So just think of it as changing the shape of the box. Correct. Yes, they're near contact. The density is high enough that there are not many holes, right? But they're near contact.
What happens?
Remember, these are frictional, right? So there are tangential and normal forces.
What happens if you increase the strain rate?
I don't know.
Would you see the pattern?
I don't know. I really don't know. These experiments haven't been done at finite shear rates.
But if you...
Yeah.
So you impose this shear, and these guys form, but if you just sit there...
If you just sit there, nothing happens. But, okay, so actually to go back to Pierre's question, let's just stop here,
right,
and I'll come back to this. If I reverse the shear, then they'll immediately fall apart.
But if you sit at that impulse shear, then it sits there.
Yeah, because there's no temperature, there's nothing. Yeah. It just sits there forever unless you go and tap them or do something. I'll show you hysteresis. Yeah. So in this regime, I'll show you hysteresis. But for these states, if you reverse the shear even just a little bit, you'll see a complete change in pattern. So one of the things that I want to talk about is how do we think about these patterns? And I don't want to I want to think about the patterns in this other sort of representation. That's what I want to get to. Okay, but this is what happens in the experiments, right? So I keep shearing. Now at this point, you have essentially created intersecting force chains. When we initially looked at these systems, the way we analyzed them is by looking at percolation of force chains by thresholding the forces. So one way you could think about this is here. The force chains have percolated only in one direction. By the time you're here, the force chains have percolated in both directions. So that's one way of thinking about these systems. But what I want to show you today is there's probably a better way of thinking about it.
Are you reversing just the film when you do that? Or
I am just reversing the film, okay. Yes. I'm just going back and forth, yeah. This is not cyclic shear. This is just forward shear, yeah. But at this point, if I now reverse the shear, it's actually stable. Up to a certain point. And you know, the question is about all of that, you know, up to a certain point. The basic question one could ask is, suppose I have done this, right? And now, how much more strain can this system sustain? Or what's the yield stress of this kind of a solid compared to, let's say, so what's the yield stress here? What's the yield stress here? How does the yield stress depend on the initial stress that was used to create them? So one point I want to make is, like, if I want to characterize these states, I'm using a stress or a strain to create them. So the only thing I can ask is, given that, how much more shear can it sustain? There's no definition of a solid at zero strain. It's not a solid at zero strain. Yes?
I understand the question. You say it depends on the history, how you get to
the shear. No, I'll not call it history. It depends on how much shear stress it has to begin with. The zero shear stress is not a solid. What I showed you, it's not a solid.
Yeah, but when I think about a solid, I define
can
it.
Can I talk solid, about?
I define it by its response to stress.
Correct. And this one has no response. If I do anything,
stress, you can define it.
That's the only way you can talk about it. Because if I don't talk about differential stress, these things have no. This is a well, right? Granular materials have no definition of strain. The zero stress state is completely ill-defined. Because if I don't do anything to them, there is no cohesion, right? So the only thing I can say is, okay, either I put this much pressure and I ask how much shear can it sustain, or I put this much shear stress and I ask how much shear can it sustain.
Additionally,
yes. Let me come to the phase diagram. Okay, so here is the phase diagram. Then you can ask. Yeah. Did you want to ask about the?
Does it need a question to ask on the first force change?
Yes. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. So, but the question is, how do we? Yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
So
yeah.
Force change is a contact chain.
No, force change. Geometric contacts don't tell you how much force they have. That's always a problem, right? So that's why I want to go into this other representation, because people have had problems with force chains because it all depends on thresholds, right? If I make the force threshold smaller and smaller and smaller, then I'll see force chains everywhere. So. Okay, so what we did when we first looked at the systems is it becomes threshold independent beyond a certain threshold. But it's a threshold dependent picture. Okay, if I want to think about force change, because it is a threshold dependent thing. So what I want to do is come up with a representation that doesn't depend on thresholds. Length scale in what? Correct. So people have forever tried to define length scales about force chains, and it's a threshold dependent thing. There are papers that, and those are all very good ways of looking at it. I think it's useful to look at the threshold dependence of things.
I missed the threshold dependence. You just mean how sensitive you are to the forces.
Right. So I'm saying, you know, if I go back here. Right, so you know, this is a threshold set by the experimental resolution. What I call a force chain depends on what threshold. Like when we analyze it, we say, okay, all of the forces above a certain value, when we looked at the percolation, we said all of the forces above a certain value will call on, and we'll, you know, look at the percolation that way. But it depends on the threshold, what I call above or below a threshold.
I guess, I mean, there's one natural threshold, which is zero
That's not a threshold.
Right, but the other, that one curve, though I don't know and how to do, is in reference, by references you have, so there, is there some sort of meaningful normal force beyond which the frictional behavior changes, and you could use that as a...
No, I don't know what you mean. Let's come back to that. I don't want to get into thresholds.
At the
end of the movie, there are no spectator cells, yes. Or there are very few. I'll tell you how many there are, actually. There are about 10%. You start off from about 10% participating in the force chains, and you end up with about 10% not participating. So this is a big difference from the kind of isotropic jamming that of frictionless systems that has been studied now for a couple of decades, where the fraction of grains not participating in force-bearing contacts is always about 10%. What goes on here is that is changing, and that's a... Yes?
In the beginning of the movie, are there percolating chains of contacts?
No.
Contacts, yes.
Contacts, I don't know. Well, if there is any contact, there's a little bit of force, so then there's a thresholding issue, right? What do you mean? The photoelastic measurements only pick up forces.
That's right.
So it's there is a natural threshold that the experiments have.
Pick up arbitrarily small threshold.
Not arbitrarily. How can it be arbitrarily small? It's an experiment.
Of course.
Right.
That was the tone of my voice.
Right.
What Marcus is asking is this initial state?
Well, so that's what I want to...
In which energy is neutral.
Okay, so I want to get away from threshold, and I want to go to a representation where within the experiments we can look at any measurable forces.
I know what you're talking about.
No, I don't think you do. I don't think you do, Jim.
But can you just remind what was the definition of the initial state?
What's the initial state?
It's a rectangular box with a given density.
So it could be...
There's no shear. There's a well-known packing pressure.
What is the packing pressure?
About 0.2. Okay, so this is... So the experiments range from here to here. The lowest one is about 0.74 in 2D. This is about 0.8. Their highest experiments are at about 0.82.
But somehow the contacts are percolating already.
It's an assumption you're making. If the contacts are percolating. No, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right, this is well below the isotropic jamming density of these particular particles. So I don't want to get into the protocol dependence of phi j. If Bob takes these very same particles, puts them in a square box, and asks, at what density do I get jammed states? There's a particular value of that packing fraction. I don't want to get into numbers, but that number is phi j. All of the experiments that I showed you until now are below that phi j, or the one experimental picture that I showed you. Shear stress. So, okay, so let me. So this phase diagram is in packing fraction, shear stress. And what you see is there are these red regions are roughly speaking where you get force chains in one direction. The green region we would call jammed in every sense of the word, because they can sustain finite additional shear stresses. So going back to what I was saying, the only thing I can ask is if I create a solid with this shear stress originally, how much more shear stress can it sustain? Okay, so we create something here. It can sustain a shear stress up to there. Beyond that, it fails. And I'll show you it's more complicated than that. In this region, you have these kinds of solids. And they fail almost immediately. But they do.
They start shear.
No. the whole pattern disappears and a new pattern shows up. And the force chain pattern, and I'll make it more quantitative.
If I go back,
if I change the shear direction slightly, right? Whatever I do, if I keep loading in the same exact direction, then it just gets stronger and stronger. But if I change the direction of the shear a little bit, or if I go back a little bit, the whole thing sort of rearranges and a new pattern shows up. So one of the things that I'll talk about is how do we think about these patterns without any kind of threshold. So I'll go into this other kind of space, and then we'll actually look at overlaps of patterns and ask what is happening to the patterns.
When it fails, you yes. mean that it undergoes some irreversible transition to a new pattern of
correct. Correct. Correct.
So, and this has to do with like one dimensionality versus.
Yeah, and you'll see very nicely in the representation that I talked about that you can almost think of a 1D to 2D transition.
So the colors to the left.
So these are not, these are fluids in some sense.
So it's obtained by looking at pictures to the right and then.
Well, in other ways too, right. So in all kinds of ways you can look at it. This is one particular way. So if I look here. Yeah, so let's this should actually be either here or there, like right on the line. So this is coming because the experiments have some friction with the table, and these were actually old experiments. So this cannot sustain, this is not a solid. So the only way you can think of even a marginal or a fragile solid is once you have these shapes. So this is here, that is there, this is again, one way of thinking about what these states are like. And what I want to get into is how do we precisely think about the patterns here, 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 and can we come up with differences between them? Yeah.
So this is all 2D?
It's all 2D.
So gravity is irrelevant.
Exactly.
So it's one monolith.
Yes. Yeah. So once you have gravity, things in some ways jam anyway. But so this is a way of sort of taking gravity out of it and asking what happens. Okay.
So, sorry. In terms of contacts, etc., even if you don't want to
yeah.
go into it, I mean, I guess the image analysis is good enough that you could construct pair correlation functions. You
sure.
could ask for what is
sure.
The Z of R
yeah,
in some limit. So
I could.
All this can be
done. All can be done. Yeah.
Is that one of the left boundary of the red region is exactly vertical? Is that obvious?
So what is known is that below this packing fraction, you cannot create any jam states.
And jam is the border, the green region, no?
Well, any kind of solid. So I don't know. So
the red is not really a solid.
It is this kind of a solid.
What you mean, I think, is that the force chain span the system.
Yeah, so that's what I said, right? This is 1D percolation of force chains, that is 2D percolation of force chains. So what I need to call it a solid or not, I'm saying there's something
that's
different
that's
between here and here. And what's different is there is no percolating force chains here at all, whatever stress I put on it, right? Once I come to this point, then an infinitesimal stress creates these force chains. And the last sort of up to there. So there's a nose to this. People have done simulations where they look at the yield stress and the yield stress shows a jump. So if you thought of this line as an yield stress line, then that's.
I'm not sure I know what you mean by yield stress, but what do you mean?
I think Marcus is saying that, you know, that boundary maybe is as a negative. Really has a negative slope.
In the sense that I can have this?
Well, in the sense that at higher tau, you have, you might go to a jam state. You know, this one of these one-dimensional jam states.
So as far as I know, that doesn't happen. As far as the experiments tell me. Now, no one has done careful simulations to you know, if I ignore the red region.
I'm just saying, you're going to start, so you have some region where there's some contact, but it's just kind of an island, which is not percolated. But, you know, you start stressing it, you will elongate.
No, this is in the presence of a stress.
Right, but I'm saying, look at the lower picture. So if you apply a stress to it, mm-hmm. now you may elongate.
Right. So if I start from a state here, that's this state. When I apply stress, that's what happens. But as far as I know, if I start from a state here, the strain needed to, at this point, okay, let me paper this way. At this point, if I ask, can I strain it enough to create a chain like that, that strain diverges. So if you want to ignore the red region, one thing that's clear is that there is a nose. Okay, and then the nature of these states is a little more murky. They are more, they're different from states up there. Okay, I'm going to, okay, so I think what I have 15 minutes, right? So what I'm going to plan to do is, explain to you why I think there is a different way of looking at this than looking at positions of brains, and then we can talk about it. And I also want to emphasize some other differences. So I think we'll all agree that the only things that we have to that can give us any kind of changes or correlations in these systems are the conditions of mechanical equilibrium. So I do something, they're sitting at zero temperature. So every grain has to have local force and torque balance. There's some global stresses imposed on the system, so the sum of the stresses of the grains have to add up to that. And there are no fluctuations, nothing's going on. I'm not vibrating them, I'm not doing anything. So this is all about static mechanical equilibrium. I have dry grains, so all of the grains, all of the contact forces are great, the normal forces are greater than or equal to zero. And then I have this condition, right, which is an inequality condition that tells me that the tangential forces are less than or equal to the friction coefficient times the normal force. If a grain has a force, every contact force has to satisfy this. So this is something that has been emphasized but forgotten, lost in the literature. Frictional systems have a microscopic indeterminacy that we are normally not used to thinking of when we think of statistical mechanics of systems. When we think of statistical mechanics of any kind of system, we think that we know the microscopic interactions completely. And then we are asking about what collective behavior emerges out of that. Here, if you give me the positions of the grains, I have no idea of what the tangential forces are. Right? All I know is that satisfies that bound. Right? So for every possible normal force, I have a bunch of tangential forces that can be there. So one of the important things is that if I want to write down microscopic states of these particles, which are static, I have to give you the positions of the grains, and I have to give you the forces. So if I want to do statmech with these systems, my microscopic states are defined not by just by positions, but by positions and forces. Does that make sense? Because I don't know what the tangential forces are.
Not knowing, not quite the same as thinking that they are really indeterminate.
They are indeterminate. They only satisfy what? An inequality.
Well,
you're saying there's many different configurations
of forces given any given set of positions.
Can the principle not be measured or something?
Sure, it can be measured. Of course, so that's what I'm saying. Then if I want to define my configuration, I have to tell you the forces. Just telling you the positions is not a complete definition of my microscopic state.
What you're saying is that in general you're not in control of this.
No, I'm saying that I'm saying if I want to specify a microscopic state of frictional grains, I have to tell you the positions and the contact forces.
What can you do?
And now normal forces are correlated, the tangent field forces might not be completely correlated.
These are normal forces, FIGM.
No, the normal, the full force, tangential and normal.
But what can you do? I can imagine that I can increase the pressure, and therefore, and then I can look at the system, and I can, or even look at the measurements of the force chains and see what the normal force is.
I can also know what the tangential forces are.
That's right. But what? But do you know? But the point is that I can imagine being able to control the normal forces experimentally.
Mm-hmm.
I think I must be able, in principle, to control the tangential forces experimentally too.
Not through some macroscopic control.
It's a very mysterious thing.
No, it's not. It's the condition of static friction, right? If I control things at the boundary, there's a whole range of tangential forces that satisfy my conditions of force and torque balance and this inequality.
But the tangential forces are physical things.
Of course.
In order to measure them, I have to move them.
No, I can measure them. That's not what I'm arguing about. It's measured. I can measure. All I'm trying to say is, okay, let me see if anyone has any problems with this. If I just tell you the positions of the grains, the configuration of the grains are not completely defined. That's not a complete definition of a microscopic state. Because what I know is that in mechanical equilibrium, it's my forces and torques that have to add up to zero. So if I ask what are the configurations that satisfy the conditions of force and torque balance, and I give you only the positions, I have no clue.
But
I need to know the forces.
But in principle, you can calculate them.
How?
When you know the forces at the boundary.
I don't know what the tangential forces are at the contact.
This
is a pretty solid, strong statement. If I give you the forces at the boundary, I don't know the tangential forces at the contact.
But you can write down all the equations and solve them.
With an inequality. Correct. When I solve them, I still have to make sure. So let's go into this isostatic argument, right? Let's say I'm isostatic. Okay? Given the geometry, I can solve for all of the forces. If there was no friction, I agree. If there's friction, I don't agree. Because you need to know. Okay.
Well, you might be looking at the...
Well, can I talk?
Yes.
I don't know what I might be looking at. I'm just saying, and this is not new. This has been known since the 90s, right? Yeah. Okay. So let's go through. I don't understand what I'm... Actually, so I don't understand what the confusion is. So on every grain, I have to satisfy, these are all the contacts on a particular grain that has to be equal to zero, a grain label, right? And I have to satisfy torques equal to zero, okay? Are you asking, Marcus, if there's a unique solution to this?
Yeah.
There isn't. Not even at the isostatic point. Because I know the number of constraints on my equation. The number of constraint equations of force and torque balance, which I wrote up there, is n into d plus 1
right.
over 2. Okay?
Well, I'm just not yet sure
I don't understand what the question is. The only thing I'm trying to say is that to define the microscopic configuration of a bunch of frictional grains, I need to tell you the positions and the forces. And I want to know why that's an issue.
I think you can just take simple example, the free particles.
Yeah, it's completely indeterminate. It depends on the preparation history. It has to be, exactly. If the FIJ is not completely correlated with my RIs, it's a separate set of degrees of freedom. So I don't know what we are arguing about. What?
How many contacts are there?
That's not enough. You have to tell me.
I want to know how many there are.
How do I know? I can measure them.
Are we talking about contacts are such that we have as many contacts that there is?
Okay, so do you want to go through the isostatic argument?
Yes.
Okay, so here is the constraint, number of constraints, right? The number of equations that I have of force and torque balance.
Yes.
Okay, so the question is how many degrees of freedom do I have? Okay? Right? So the isostatic argument is I have to satisfy force and torque balance, and my unknowns are the forces at every contact, correct? The unknowns here are the FCGs. That's the question. So how many are there? All I know, the RCs are given. It's a given geometry, let's say. Right? So I'm going back to the isostatic argument. All I know is this, right? Okay? So on certain contacts, I might have satisfied this bound. There may be a fraction of my contacts in my system where I have satisfied this bound. For those contacts, I have only the normal forces are unknown. The tangential forces are not unknown. For the other contacts, I have two components that are unknown. So the number of unknowns depends on how many contacts have been satisfied. And that's a completely preparation dependent thing. So if you want to generalize the isostatic argument, you can do it with the number of contacts, but specifying how many of these are there. Even after that, okay, let's say I tell you how many those are. I go back and solve my linear system of equations and I find all of the forces. I still have to make sure they satisfy this constraint.
But suppose they are zero.
There are zero of these only in the limit of infinite friction, and there you can figure it out.
That's not
why. Because if mu is infinite, you are never saturating this bound.
But why can't you have other?
Well, you can have some. I don't know how many. Right?
Okay, then can we talk about configuration?
What are we talking about? I'm thinking a very simple statement, right? And I think. If the forces, so this tells me that the forces are not given if I know the positions. And then in my microscopic degrees of freedom, I need to keep positions and forces. I don't see what this is.
You're right. You're making a very simple statement.
Yes.
The language of 19th century physics. Charles reminds me that what this is called is non-holonomic constraint.
Yes.
It's a simplification of what we think of as the frictional action.
What is the simplification?
Just exactly what you're saying. In fact, in the 21st century, or even in the 20th century, we think there are real atoms that are sitting there, and that there are real forces that could even be measured in some way. But you're making a nice, simplified model of the system, and it just...
I'm making an accurate model of granular systems sitting at zero momentum. The only things I have are the positions and the forces.
No,
I don't think I'm simplifying it anyway at all.
In terms of... No, but...
Okay, let me just finish in the next 5 minutes, then we can argue for the rest of the next 2 months, right? I really want to get this point across. There's a very nice way of imposing force and torque balance on grants. by introducing essentially gauge potentials. And what I want to argue is once, so going back to this, what I want to argue is that if I can introduce some representation where the top part and the bottom part and this are satisfied automatically, then I have introducing some fields on which the only constraint I have to think about is that one.
We can impose not all limit condition constraints.
Correct.
Using these, right?
Right. But this I can. I'll show you why.
Yeah.
But this I cannot.
Right.
Right. But I want to go into a representation where these three are automatically satisfied. And then I want to ask what kinds of correlations are induced in that representation due to these constraints. Okay? Okay, so some of you know this, some of you probably don't know this. So there are two sets of really gauge potentials or gauge fields. One are vector and another is a scalar. There's a relation between the two, which is also another constraint that needs to be thought about, and it can be rephrased in terms of this friction one. So let me first look at the vector fields. So the way you do this is, and it was done originally by Ball and Blumenfeld, then we did a lot of it, and the most recent, sort of most comprehensive, is done by Eric Digwilly, and I put that on the wiki, his most recent paper. His thesis is out there too, which is beautiful. So I have a grain. Let's look at the center grain. I have four contacts on it. I have four forces, including tangential forces. Whatever, these are force vectors sitting at these contacts. These forces have to add up to zero. So what you can do is you can introduce sort of currents, vector currents, that are circulating on these loops. Okay, so once you give me the geometry, all of these are completely defined. Right, so this is a grain contact, this is another contact, this is another contact, this is another contact.
Can you explain what one black arrow means?
Yeah, I am. This is one contact on a grain, this is another contact on that particular grain, so I'm connecting them. Okay?
These are not representations of forces, are they?
No, they are just lines, right? The forces are sitting at these contacts.
Okay,
these are just geometrical lines. Here's another contact, here's another grain that I haven't drawn.
What's the orientation?
So you take, so this is for whoever has done this in any other kinds of context, there is a convention. So I always go counterclockwise. Okay, so the currents go counterclockwise. It's a gauge field, so I can choose that vector to be zero, let's say on this circulating loop. As I step through the contacts on that next loop, I'll increment this vector current by the force that I have crossed. I do the same thing around. I come back because the forces add up to zero. I have a unique current. Right? So this is a completely dual representation. I can now, if I want, remove the grains completely.
The current loops always have an empty spot in the middle.
These are grains. The loops move. So the loops live on the voids.
That's what I said.
So if I remove the grains, right, imagine I remove the grains, I'll have these, right? And there are circulating currents on these loops. Okay, so this is just Kirchhoff's laws. I can add up the currents, I can think. So if I give you all the loops, you can get all the forces.
So how the forces are taken from the loops?
So the difference between these two will give you the forces.
Your microphone?
Okay, I'll write down the equation.
This is specific to
2D? There's a formulation in 3D where these fields are actually now tensors, not vectors, so they are not so easily represented. But in Eric's thesis, there is a representation.
So you have vector variables which live in the void.
The vector variables, think of them really living on those loops, right?
So if you have link variables.
But the link variables are vectors.
And they represent vector forces on the clock heads or not?
No, so the force at this contact, really think of it as a Kirchhoff's law. The force at this contact is the difference between the current flowing in and the current flowing out. Right? Really, the force on this grain is the current flowing in minus the current flowing out. The force on this grain, because of Newton's third law, is the current flowing in minus the current flowing out. It's the negative.
That tells me that I can get the forces purely geometric.
No. The values of these are dependent on the forces. The loop geometries are geometric.
That's what I was saying.
The loop geometries, but the value of the current on the loops is completely described by the forces. Okay, so we resorted to calling them height fields because that's coming from frustrated anti-ferromagnets. We call them heights. There's a big difference between people who have looked at that. There, the heights are always discrete. Here, the heights are continuous. These vector fields are continuous because the forces can be arbitrarily small. Right. So going back to your thing, the forces can be infinitesimal. So the differences between these can be infinitesimally small. So there's no threshold. There's no scale to these. So that's just a comment. So the force balance can be imposed by, or can be, so if instead of thinking of forces, I can think of these loop variables, the heights, and I have, and every configuration of loop variables gives me a force balance configuration. Sure, you can think of them as leading, and that's what, I'll probably not get to it, but yeah. So
in the 0, 0, you specify.
I'm just saying I pick an arbitrary origin because it's a gauge.
That's fine. Okay, that's a vector. So, but every loop is generated by a vector or
yes.
A scalar?
A vector. So there's a vector current flowing on this loop.
Oh, I see.
Or as Pierre is saying, and this is what we will ultimately end up doing, there's a vector current that's living on this void. You just don't know where it's living, unless you say it's living.
Subtracted from the neighboring void.
Yes. So I subtract these two. I subtract this from that. I get the force at that point. And again, you have to say I'm going counterclockwise around this grain. So when I do that, I get the forces on that grain. Because of Newton's third law, if I do this, I'll get the forces on this grain. Okay, so these height fields completely satisfy all of Newton's second law and third law. And for any configuration of height, gives me a force balance configuration. But I also have to satisfy torque balance. And to do that, you actually have to introduce another scalar consumption, which also lives on the loops. So you can think of now I have two things, but because of force, these two are not independent, right? The torque and the force are not independent. There's a constraint connecting, so rho are the heights, constraint connecting the heights and the scalar consumptions. Okay, so that's the representation. Should I take Karen?
Yeah, let's keep going
for 5 more minutes?
Okay, yeah, sure.
Okay, so let me actually skip the experiments for now, and what should I do? What do you guys want to see? So from this point, what I wanted to go to is what we have done using this representation to analyze the shear jam state, because I don't have a theory, as Dio keeps saying, and I have said to anyone that is willing to listen, I don't know how to impose that non-holonomic frictional constraint. All I know is that it induces some correlations between these fields. So I want to demonstrate how that has happened. But so let me quickly go through the experiment.
Yeah.
That slide was good.
Correct. So what I can do is I can translate these into conditions on normal and tangential forces. I'm not gonna write, it's horrible. Yeah. One thing that you can see from here is that if I only worry about force balance, the geometry of the grains never comes in. Right? Where the positions are never comes in, that first equation. But no. So but if I want, as soon as I impose torque balance, the two are coupled. Right? So okay, so Sid wants to see experiments. So actually let's look at the experiments because so these are these experiments on the video that I showed you, right? Okay, so the first figure here is looking at the pressure as a function of strength for different pack interactions.
Strength
squared. Mm-hmm. Yep. And there's no reason that the pressure should depend on shear strength, right? So this is what this is telling you, is what this is reflecting is the fact that the number of grains bearing forces is going up with the strength. So that's why the pressure is going up. The pressure is not going up in an elastic way in any sense. What the strain is doing is increasing the what we call the non-rattler fraction, the fraction of grains that are part of the force-bearing network in any way at all. So if you start from very low packing fractions, it takes a lot of strain to go up to something that's significant. If you start from a higher packing fraction, it reaches saturation faster. All of these, we can scale on top of each other. I have that at the end of the talk, but I'm not going to get to it. Going back to streams, these are the number of contacts. So one thing that we found is if you plotted pressure, number of contacts, shear stress, whatever, as a function of this, not the packing fraction, then everything collapses roughly on top of each other. So what controls what's going on is the non-rattler fraction, not the nominal packing fraction. What you do see is that the shear stress actually first goes up. This is the stress anisotropy, so actually tau divided by p. It's much more anisotropic here, and then, and this is the same FNR, sorry. It actually has a peak and then goes down. So things become more isotropic at higher strains. So nothing like an elastic material, if you want to think about it. Yeah.
The P you're measured here is hydrostatic pressure.
The P is measured, everything is measured by looking, measuring the stress, individual grain stress tensors, and summing them up.
Okay. That's a normal sense, that's a mechanical sense.
The mechanical sense, the Cauchy stress tensor.
If you look at your number 12A, the one on the upper
yes.
right, right? And now can you look at that curve and tell me, is there a point at which you say you have jamming? Or
no, so what I want to say is this is what, before we got into the game, Behringer and people identified this point as where they say things are jammed right. because the pressure showed this rapid rise.
Right.
What, if I got to it, I would show you is there is a clear signature in this space of height variables that lets me understand what that transition is.
Okay, but tell us in words what it is. And I don't understand this bottom graph. What is it? Is the stress?
Stress as a function of the non-rattler fraction.
The non-rattler fraction.
Yes.
Why should I think that it should?
Why should you think? This is what happens in the experiment. I don't know why you should think that.
I want you to tell me your physical information okay. about what's going on if that thing just drops.
It's basically what you saw in that video, that beyond a certain strain, you're getting crossing force networks and your whole thing is becoming much more isotropic.
Okay.
So the stress tensor is becoming isotropic.
What about ideas like
elasticity and plasticity?
I want to introduce the idea of localization.
Ooh.
Okay. I mean, I know it's a dangerous word, but But if you look at your two curves on the upper right, so you have P versus FNR.
Yeah.
It's much more striking in terms of this sudden increase.
Mm-hmm.
You look at your Z, it's fairly mild, mm-hmm. right? But nonetheless, it's the same system, right? You're just looking
yes.
at some different attributes.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to focus on the upper right, well, that's a very, very striking variation. So one has to ask, what is going on at those critical values?
I do. So okay, so maybe I should show you what we see, and then we can come back to this. But what I did want to say is, okay, so let me first say that this shows us that the response to strain of these systems are quite unusual. Okay, so, and then there is this identification that the experimentalists had made, actually not quite, they had done other things, but we told them to plot things versus FNR, that this is a shear jamming transition. I just wanted to show you a shear as a function of shear stress as a function of strain, because I think if I just showed this to you, the normal reaction would be, oh, this is elastic, then there's plastic failure, and something happens. Right? Stress versus strain. Not true. Okay? The reason it's not true is if I look here, there's strong, strong hysteresis. Okay. So this is the hysteresis in that regime of strain. Okay? So what's going on is that's different. So I think if I want you guys to take one message from this, what's going on here that's different from normal response to strain is that strain is increasing the number of frictional contacts. In addition to creating shear stress at every grain, it's bringing more and more grains into the network.
Isn't that the same as saying that the system is undergoing some irreversible?
Sure, that's why I say that this is not elastic.
In fact, the particles are rearranging.
Yes, so that's why I say this is not elastic,
exactly.
Even though it looks elastic.
That becomes a very interesting question.
Okay, so let me just show you what we have. So I'm going to... Which ones? Hang on, ask me again. So this is... stress and isotropy as a function of strain. Oh, right. So look at this. So this is 20% strain. Okay, and this is about 10% strain. So the hysteresis is this is a packing fraction at 0.825. So below phi j, but reasonably close to it. And this is 1% strain. 2% strain, right? So it's in that linear part. So it's here. 0.825 is this, the red curve. So I'm sort of here.
Is the region that we have 1D portions?
Yes, 1D portions.
I mean, there's a difference if I increase slightly the grain fraction?
Yes, the nature of the hysteresis loops changes. And we can explain, so yeah, I don't have enough time. What? This is hysteresis. What?
I was on the graph before, and there are three different curves, and I'm supposed to learn something.
The three different curves are three different packing fractions.
And there's
what is
three
different?
What? No, let me ask. So, what are you asking? Okay, so what you should gather from this, and again, is that what changes crucially from one packing fraction to another is it what's the typical strain at which that peaking happens?
Regarding the absence of an elastic regime,
yes,
this is in principle no different than what you generally see in a proper solid.
No, it is different.
It is different.
It is different. Because you're increasing the number of contacts. You never do that in an amorphous thermal solid. You are starting from already existing springs in an amorphous solid.
Well, no, I don't think you want to think about it. But think about it.
Okay, I can come back. Let me finish, and then I'll come back to amorphous solids. There must be similarities, but I don't think it's exactly the same because this is zero temperature. Okay, so let me just forget this. So I'm going to show you, so we can forget all of this. This is a slightly different representation of the vector fields that I talked about. I'm showing you exactly the same thing. So instead of rho, I have called those H's. But I can represent them in this reciprocal space where I'm completely forgetting about the geometry of the packing. And I'm saying those red points are these heights. And the edges connecting those heights are the contact forces.
And each one is a difference of the two.
Each one is a difference of the two.
Two is a difference of H2 minus H2.
Exactly, right? So it's just a vector map, right?
The edges of the line integral is zero.
Exactly. And now this polygon belongs to one grain.
Right.
Yeah. And then if I look at, let's say, the edge F4, that's shared with another grain. That grain has its own polygon.
Yeah.
So I get a tiling. Well, I'm completely, the height map is actually a really true dual because I have those loop geometries. So I'm sort of simplifying and I'm forgetting about those geometries of the loops.
The
dipoles
are the same.
Well, the thing is, if I want to talk about torques, I have to go back to that. But as long as I'm doing this, I don't have to. So what I want to ask and what we will ask is, this is actually one of the configurations taken from Bob Berenger's experiments. And I should have drawn these with red dots. These are the red dots that I get from that force balance configuration. And all I have drawn are these, the vertices, the heights.
I extract
the H's. Right. But I know that the H's are connected in some way here, because every grain has a polygon associated with it. I haven't drawn it. Okay? So the question I'm asking is, so what I said before is any force balance configuration can be represented, if I think of it this way. Okay, so I have to define one more thing. There are two big arrows here, which I have called Fx and Fy. They're the difference in the heights as I march across the y direction in my grain packing or along the x direction in my grain packing. So all of the points have to lie within these boundaries. And because the forces are all positive, the height marches up monotonically. It doesn't come back to zero. Like if I had attractive forces, if the forces could be negative, I could start from an origin and I could go slightly far away in my grain packing and I can hit zero again. Does that make sense? But because the forces are positive, that doesn't happen. So the simplification is that I have only one sheet of these vertices here. If I had attractive forces, maybe I go this far, and then I get an origin again. So I have to come back here and start doing another sheet. Does that make sense? Big F and big F, Fx and Fy are the difference in the heights if I march along the x direction or the y direction in my grain pack.
Is it across the system?
Across the system. So this corresponds to my boundary, boundary forces. Yeah. Yeah, this is the global stress that's applied. So when Bob Berenger changes his shear stress, I change the shape of this box.
What do you call reciprocal space?
Because it doesn't have, it has no information about the positions. It has only information about the forces. You can call it whatever you want.
Looks like a dual space, right?
It is a dual space, but it's not a true dual. You can come back to it because it doesn't have all of the information about the geometry. So what I want to make, so this satisfies, these things are, because it's positive, the positivity of the forces just tells me I don't have to deal with multiple sheets. So what I want to ask is, do the other constraints, which I haven't imposed here, right, the torque balance and the frictional, introduce correlations between these points? Because if those constraints were not there, these things should be perfectly uncorrelated, because all configurations satisfy force balance and the positivity of the forces. So if only thing I had was positivity of the forces, some global stress, and force balance, then you give me this boundary, I throw in n points, where n corresponds to the number of contacts I have, And any point pattern satisfy force balance. So if there are any correlations between these, they have to come from the other constraints, which I don't know how to impose. What? But what I'm asking is, do correlation. The torque balance, which I haven't imposed. I know. I know and I don't.
You've already imposed these two constraints.
So the pattern that I have generated here, of course, satisfies those constraints.
Right.
What I'm saying is, if those constraints were not there, then if all that I had was some global stress and force balance, then I could just rearrange these points in any way that I want to. And that would be valid. But that's not. So the experiments, which are force and torque balance, the torque balance constraint and the inequality constraint, will lead to some correlations between these points. And I want to ask what happens to those correlations as I go through what the experiment is called, the shear jamming transition. Okay?
Somehow as you increase the force, the number of points increases, doesn't it?
Exactly. So so two things happen. The number of points increase and the shape of the box changes. So you can almost think of it as sort of a density functional theory in this space or something like that. But the constraints are hard to impose, that non-holonomic constraints. I don't remember. But let me show you.
Sorry, when you think of a total vector force, supposed to breaking it down into tangential and then we've imposed all.
No, I still have torque balance. I haven't, like, the height fields haven't imposed torque balance.
The field that imposes the torque balance.
Right, which I haven't. So I'm saying, so maybe the other way of saying it is I have another scalar field.
Yeah, there's some red points or something.
Right, this is also important because the configuration, I'm saying, okay, so I probably don't have enough time to.
There's not all the constraint and tangent.
Yes.
That's somehow hidden in the.
It's what is hidden in it actually is the kinds of polygons you can get. I don't have time to go into that. So if I have frictionless grains, friction coefficient is zero,
right.
All of these polygons have to be convex. And that's a strong constraint on these points. Now, when I have friction, that's no longer true, but it still constrains the kinds of polygons I can get. So I want to just end up saying I don't know how to do this rigorously theoretically, but what I want to show you is what happens when we look with this lens at the experiment. So what we look at is an analog of what I would do if I wanted to understand amorphous solids. I look at the density of points, but in this space, not the density, the local density of grains or the local density of atoms. I look at the density of points in this space and I ask if there's a persistence of pattern. So if I look at rho of h at this strain step, and then I change fx and fy a little bit, and I distort my pattern affinely and subtract that off. So I'm looking at deviations from a completely affine strain response in this space. And I'm creating the analog of a spin glass overlap parameter. So I have an overlap matrix in this density space. So I'm saying I can calculate this density at one strain step. I can calculate this density at a different strain step. And I ask, what is the overlap? So I put a grid on this. I count the number of points. And I just do an overlap. This is just a schematic. Right. Which these are the polygons. Right. So the vertices are the heights. Right. So in the previous one I hadn't drawn the polygons. I'm saying
the vertices of these polygons are those points on the right.
Correct. Right. And so what this was meant to show is that if I had the convexity condition, strict convexity condition, then you can see why correlations should appear. I can imagine doing a Monte Carlo where I just want to move the vertex. But because of the convexity constraint, I can't move it out of the environment. So there are sort of effective springs in the system coming from the fact that there are constraints on the kinds of polygons you can build. So if this was frictionless, I know how to impose the constraint. It's a convexity constraint. For the frictional, I don't know exactly how to impose the constraint on the geometry. Okay, so this is the overlap. So this is an overlap matrix, right? So I take the pattern, some way of measuring it in one strain step. I take the overlap with it at a different strain step. So these are strain steps, so it's a matrix. At low values of the strain, where there is no force change at all, like no, not even 1D force change, or forget about it. This is what you see in the experiment. So what do you see in the overlap matrix? That at low strains, the overlap is non-zero only on the diagonal. Right? So if I create a pattern at this strain step, it doesn't survive at all. But once I get here, it survives for a little bit. Two different strain steps. Think of two spin glass trajectories. I'm taking an overlap of two trajectories. Here I'm taking an overlap of two different snapshots at two different strain steps.
The tiling remains the same, I mean the top.
No. What do you mean? They're changing.
They're connected to loops, right? And are the loops always the same? Are the contacts changing?
This doesn't give you that information. But contacts do break. But contacts mostly break at these points.
I don't even understand the color.
The color code is telling you how high the overlap is. If the overlap is 1, the pattern has perfect overlap. Yeah. So here, of course, on the diagonal, the overlap is always 1.
So there's some jumps, no?
It's an overlap between two configurations.
So two configurations of these point patterns, the heights.
I move the points in a consistent way with convexity, let's say.
No, I don't do. This is from experiments. Okay. So I take two point patterns generated from the experiment, right? And I want to construct an overlap of these.
And this corresponds to the same...
experiment.
No, same experiment, different external forces.
Correct. So I'm taking my FX, FY box. So the point is, how do I compare two different FX, FY box shapes? So what we do is we put a grid that changes FI and D with that box, right? And then I can do that counting.
Relative
to the FI.
The overlap between one configuration and the next one that you get to by changing the external.
Yes, so it's
not something from the beginning.
No, not from the beginning. So I look at, so I put a grid on this, I count the number of points in each grid, and that gives me a density pattern. And then I change FX and FY.
By some small step,
whatever the experiments do, the next train step, right? Which is small, right? And then I change my grid finally with that. And then I again count. And then I take an overlap of that.
The points correspond more or less to space?
No, not at all.
So this is totally abstract, I mean...
That's what I say, it's a reciprocal space. It has no positional information in it.
No, but if two points are close together...
Until I give you the polygons, you don't know that.
Yeah, but then what is the meaning of correlating points in some small region here in space can correspond?
So these are connected by polygons.
So what is the space in which you're drawing?
FX and FY. It's the space of heights. It is the space of heights. It has no positional information. It has the topological information around the
polygon. There is space to polygon in force.
Say that again?
No.
What polygon in real space?
So what does the line to mean by it?
That's only in force space.
What are you drawing?
This one?
Yeah,
it's in force space.
In space.
No, there's no polygon here. What polygon? No, but the lengths of these are just the forces. It has no relationship to the geometry. It really doesn't, because of the tangential forces. I can have huge tangential forces. It really doesn't. The topology is preserved. The topology is preserved in this map. If a grain has four contacts, I'll have a four-sided polygon. But that four-sided polygon, but the four-sided polygon can be this or can be that. No, okay. Okay, you guys know more than I do, so yeah. So I'm saying I can have a four-sided polygon that looks like that, or I can have a four-sided polygon that looks like this in four space. So if you want to say that reserves the topology, then yes. It doesn't tell me anything about the real space topology, real space geometry. It tells me that the grain has four contacts. Okay, so.
The orientation of the sides of the polygon is the direction of the forces?
Yes.
And the length is proportional to the force, is really the force vector?
Yeah, these vectors are the force vectors, but I'm saying they are not uniquely related to the positions.
In force space, you're also making a loop in the space.
Yes, correct.
So there's some connection.
Correct, but it doesn't tell me the shape of the loops in real space. Yeah. And what the reason I keep coming back to that is it's not a strict dual. To do the torque balance, I actually need to know those loop geometries in real space, Okay, so this is what we see, right? So this is what the experiment is called shear jamming. But you see there's a change, but I think it's much more subtle than that, right? So what you see is that overlaps develop. Things actually do fail. Right, so the overlap, so if I start something here, up to that strain, the pattern stays roughly the same, but then the pattern changes. Beyond some strain, at least as far as they have gone, they don't see a failure anymore. Okay, so if you want to call, so I'm just saying this is a nice way of looking at how the correlations, so here there are strong correlations between one strain step and another strain step. Here there are very little correlations. So the grains in looked at it from this perspective develop some persistence of patterns as you increase the strain at a given packing fraction where that happens. And if I change the packing fraction, the black lines are where these are experiments, they actually had missing configurations, we didn't have them. But this is at a higher packing fraction, sort of a self-similar structure, it just happens at a lower strain. So packing fraction is not that important. So you can come up with sort of a measure of that length of the square. So I don't know why my student called this epsilon star, but this is, let's say I've created something at strain 10%, and I ask, how much more strain can it sustain? Right, so this is that. And what you see is, this is a lower packing fraction, that's a higher packing fraction. So you can think of this as a kind of an order parameter, which is nothing but just the length of these squares, like with some thresholding. And we can scale these on top of each other by defining a packing fraction dependent characteristic strain. There's a very particular power law associated with that. And this is just for current. When we map it onto this random field spin model, we get that scaling correct from the random field spin model. Okay, so this to me is a clear transition. Right, so at some gamma naught, I transition from not surviving any incremental strain to be able to survive more and more incremental strains.
Do you have a name for that transition?
No. Well, they call it shear jamming.
Oh, okay.
But let me see if I have anything. I'm going to skip. Well, I've gone way over in time. I actually do want to share this.
But is that now just the border of this green region in the phase diagram?
This is in terms of strain. If I... if I take the stress corresponding to this strain, that's the jamming phase diagram that I drew.
So those different colors represent...
two different packing fractions.
Initial packing density?
The packing density never changes.
Okay. So those are represent what?
Different colors or different packing fractions?
Different packing fractions, but all I'm saying is not initial. They don't change through the process.
They are different packing densities.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to skip this. I can show this to, this is what I wanted to show, but I will show that later. You want me to show this? Okay, so this is what happens to these tilings. And I'm going to start from somewhere here. These are the experimental tiles. This is what Pierre was telling you about yesterday. Yeah. So you start from something, oh, the one that you saw, where it's more clear is where it's not scaled, which I don't have here. Yeah, so you certainly get a more robust network emerging, if you want to think of it as a network. The reason you're not seeing the what Pierre was calling the decoupling is I've scaled all of the forces to unity. So you actually start from something completely crumpled, and then you extend out.
The fact that it expands, that's obvious, just because you're increasing the total change, right?
But it's the question of how they organize inside.
I want to argue that's actually more crumpled because you're increasing the number of contacts, so you're talking about wrinkling it more.
Yep.
Which is what it looks like when you scale it down. Yep.
Okay, so I just wanted to show you one thing. I keep saying that the shape of the polygons matter. So for frictional grains, you can actually get non-convex polygons, which you cannot get in the frictionless case in this geometric representation, right? It has nothing to do with non-convex shapes of grains or positions. It's the force tilings. What you see is the clear correlation with the shear stress, and that's very easy to understand geometrically. But what you do see is that the number of the fraction of non-convex polygons goes up and then goes down again. And this is, again, maybe of interest to people interested in avalanches. So this is one particular run, and what you're looking at is the number of non-convex polygons as a function of the strain step. And you do see events like this, right? Where the stress drops and the number of non-convex polygons drop. And what you see, the red points are where the non-convex polygons are. So this is at that point. And then this is where the number of non-convex polygons have dropped. What you see is that it's a correlated event. All of that whole cluster of red points there have disappeared. So I don't want to say this, but I think these are close to the STZs in these systems, where failure happens. But okay, let me just stop there. So I want to say that to revert back to what I was saying, there are correlations that are introduced by the torque balance. There are correlations that are introduced between the height points due to torque balance and this frictional, static friction inequality. I don't understand how to impose that theoretically, but I see that that's what gives rise to changes in the correlations as I increase the strain step. And if I just looked at the positions of the grains, and I didn't have time to do this, as I go through this shear jamming transition, I see nothing. So I could do the exact analogous overlap function, define it in position space. I do rho of r and do an overlap. It's one throughout. Nothing's happening. Unless I look at small contact breaking, which I completely like. That's something that might give us some information. So all I'm saying is, because of mechanical equilibrium, looking in this space of heights and these fields might actually give us a better way of understanding what goes on in the system. Okay, I'm done.